Yeah. So, okay. Here at the ranch, we've got a couple horses and cattle and everything. And anyway, so I was kind of off riding to go take a look at the cattle. We had one of our big events over the weekend, and I hadn't really had a chance to go out and check on them. So anyway, I was this horse kind of has a bad habit of moving a little bit when you mount him. Like you put a foot in the stirrup, and he kind of starts to take off a little bit.
Gotcha.
Normally, you just kind of grab on the reins and he calms down, but I haven't ridden him in probably since like May or something like that. So,
Got all the jokes.
yeah, we're definitely going to use that audio clip right
Yeah,
there.
I haven't ridden him since May. That one, it's a classic. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway.
Haven't ridden him since May, and I'm trying to tell a story here, guys. But
Yeah.
so I put my foot in his, stirrup.
So he. As I start to kind of put my foot in the stirrup and swinging my leg over, he just takes off running, and I didn't really have a my foot kind of caught in the stirrup, and I lost balance, and I basically fell off the horse and caught myself with my left arm as it hit the ground, and it just popped the bone out of joint right at the elbow, and so
It didn't break it at all, did it?
no, it didn't break at all. It just I
That's
thought it was broken
awesome.
because, like, when I got up, my arm was like bending backwards, it was just kind of like a
Right.
skin sock.
Just threw up a little bit.
The old skin
the old
sock.
skin sock.
Another clip that we're going
The
to
old
use.
skin sock. Oh my
I haven't ridden him since May, and just like the old skin sock.
Dude, the pain. Oh my gosh.
Oh, it
Describe
was
the
horrible.
pain.
Yeah, yesterday
Excruciating.
was terrible. Today is a little more manageable. That's not too bad.
Since you're drinking your
Yeah,
medicine.
yeah. Well, I was just thinking about that. It's probably not a good thing to mix with the painkillers, but
That's for Brad.
Dude.
That has to happen every time to start for Brad.
It's got
Yeah.
to. It does. It does. So, to our new listeners, this is Everything Is Okay podcast. There's a new voice you're hearing right now, and you're probably asking yourself, oh my gosh, who is this guy? Or you know that voice, and you're thinking to yourself, yes, please, can I have more?
I'm going with that one.
Yeah, let's go with that one. Let's go with that one.
Are you walking
if you're new
through
to our
people's
podcast,
inner dialogue right now?
Hey. Hey. I'm going to do what I do
That was
to
a great comeback. That was
my
a great comeback right there.
five-week-year-old. That's right. My child, who's 5 weeks old, who my wife just called and said rolled over for the first time. About 2 minutes before I got on this call. True story.
Oh, you missed it.
I shush him, James. I shush him. So, to our new listeners, Everything Is Okay podcast
Worst
is
intro ever.
The intersection of faith and life and questions. We don't have the answers. We're searching for more information. And luckily, we found out what happens when your elbow decides to separate. And I had a question about that, but I don't anymore. And that's what this podcast is about. This is it, guys. We're living life straight up.
What does
Brad
it take
refuses
to turn
to talk right
an
now.
Arm into a
skin sock? Yeah.
Yeah. And if you believe in God, what does God have to say about that? That's what we're trying to do. That's the focus of James didn't like that. He likes to assume that God doesn't care about elbows. So
Jacob, what sin did you do to cause yourself to dislocate your elbow?
That's a good question.
Oh,
that would be the topic of our conversation today.
That's
this could go
Baptist
really dark
right
really quick.
That's a reference to episode 4 of this podcast where we talked about God's ideal.
Ooh,
that was
nice.
Episode 4?
That was episode 4.
That was
with
so
the
long
good,
ago.
With the good
wow.
people known as the Skillerns.
Good guys.
Yes.
Oh, they are so good. Very good people. Oh my gosh.
So what, Brad, did I bring down, Brad, what did I bring down the mood or something?
No.
Yeah,
no.
Way to go, Brad. Oh,
yes. Yeah, way to talk about two people that have it together and that have faith regardless of the worst situations. Thank you so much, man. Brad, what have you been up to?
I saw Jacob this weekend.
That's true.
Really?
So is Jacob a story?
Oh, yeah. Because y'all had the thing where you know mutual people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we know mutual. He knows my family.
Yeah.
Interesting.
We're best buds.
Who is that?
Sarah.
Her name is Sarah. Yeah. Yeah. And she, you know, she's my cousin. She now lives there in Claremore. They moved there after college, and they know more about Claremore than my family does, and my family's always lived there. So
that's Claremore, Oklahoma, to our Virginia listeners. Continue.
That's right. Hello, Virginia. Thank you for being the number one state in America that listens to our podcast.
To the Everything is Okay podcast that has Oklahoma in the logo. Thank you, Virginia. We love you. Everything is okay unless you turn the news on.
You got me on the on the episode this week, so you're going to get the Oklahoma bump.
I hope so.
All those Oklahomans are going to tune it in.
But to be real,
my gosh.
Oklahoma is pretty far behind both Mississippi and Virginia. I mean, at this point, Japan is going to catch Oklahoma before too long.
That's unacceptable.
Japan has overtaken Oklahoma by far.
Unacceptable.
Really?
By quite a margin.
Oh, man. Wow.
So
at this point, France is going to overtake Oklahoma probably in the next month. Just saying.
Snap.
All right, so we're referencing earlier conversation actually about we thought we'd have a pretty impressive listenership from Oklahoma since the three of us and four on this call to Jacob Crumwitty, yeah. What up?
We had hoped.
All have roots in Oklahoma. And, you know, that was one of the thought processes when we were coming up with the name for this podcast. We were like, all right, we want to talk about faith and Oklahoma and why so many amazing people come from Oklahoma. And then we realized, oh my gosh, it should be Everything is Virginia. And I mean, you understand why we struggled with that. I mean, it makes sense. Like, we don't really, I don't know, I've never lived in Virginia. So and I figured everything was about me, not Everything is okay. So I'm struggling over here. I'm struggling.
Everything is Mississippi, just takes too long.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Everything's sippy.
It doesn't quite roll off the tongue.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. So Jacob Crumwitty, man, let's tell a quick story.
Uh-oh. All right.
Off the cuff of, I mean, you're talking to James Eisenhower, Brad Stair, and David Meggs right now.
Correct.
When you think about the three of us, and you think about just the tomfoolery,
oh, the shenanigans
that happened from our youth, whether or not it was junior high or high school or after that, like, what do you think of? What jumps in your mind?
I think of quite a bit. Like, I mean, you guys and Adam, like Matt and Philip and Drew and everyone else we kind of hung out with in high school, I mean, you guys were it for me. I mean, you guys were my friends. You guys at least went to like public schools where you saw everyone else, you know, in the
other
at
humans
school.
Continue.
Other people, yeah. But like being mostly homeschooled and I went to a small private school.
I actually met you before I met either of these guys.
That's true.
We were
I've
in second grade together at Westside.
Second grade, yeah. Yeah. So like I've known James for quite a while. What? And then Brad. And then, David, you came along fairly soon after that, probably like third or fourth grade. And then, Brad,
that's
it wasn't
right.
Until like junior high or high school, I think.
Yeah, I didn't show up in the youth group until seventh grade, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, the very first person I was able to actually go to their house on my own was riding my bike to your house.
Yeah, I remember that, man. Like, and it was crazy because, like, we had to... It was, I don't know, it was like a mile and a half away
something like that.
And we're like
that's an adventure in itself.
We're like 7 or 8 year old kids just kind of riding our bikes wherever across town.
Yep.
Just different times, man. It was good stuff. Yeah. So anyway, like, yeah, you guys, I mean, you guys were my pretty much, that sounds stupid. I was going to say, you guys were my whole life, but that's kind of the case. I mean, as far as social circles, I didn't really have many others.
So any ridiculous stories come to mind involving, I don't know, plastic guns or tackling trash cans or, I mean, is there...
Freestyle walking. Being, I mean, in Boston.
We were
mission
goofy
trips.
Kids, man.
Dude,
we were
any,
crazy.
Any number of things.
There's
a lot.
There was so many, like, I mean, I'm not even kidding. Every single time we hung out, it was something stupid. I mean, David, like, I think one of my favorite memories of, like, you is, like, when you and me and Zach Ramey, I think, we went to Cornerstone. And that
yes!
was...
Yes!
That was like right after,
dude.
Was it either you had graduated or I had graduated high school? So it was like one of those coming of age sort of things. Like the first time I went on a big trip by myself, you know, without
dude,
parents and
we were younger
supervision.
Than that, man. We hadn't graduated.
I did.
Cause I remember.
I had.
You had. All right. Well, you're a year older. Okay. Cause I remember didn't I take my mom's giant Econo Lodge van?
Yeah. Yeah. Zach Ramey was sleeping in the back seat the whole time, and this was kind of before, like, you know, you could just like Google Map something. So like we were trying to figure it out, like on Maps, and man, it was fun.
Back in the glory days,
dude. I remember from that time actually wearing some goofy cowboy hat and shorts and hunting down David Bazan of Page of the Lion and actually nutting up and going and talking to him.
I remember
as a idiot high schooler.
I remember you found him in the he was practicing in a shed somewhere, and you were like,
yes,
literally like
yes.
It was like Sandlot or something. You had your face pressed up against the this like shed that was falling apart, and you could like see through the cracks, just kind of face
dude,
pressed
creeper.
Up against for like 20 minutes.
Such a creeper. Dude,
yeah, David Bazan is never going to come on our podcast now if he ever hears this. He's like, oh God! What
yeah,
a creeper!
Like literal
yeah,
creeper.
I remember that.
I hope he does come on this podcast and somehow remembers that.
Just remember this dude. Little set of beady eyes watching him.
Yeah, I remember during his performance at Cornerstone that year, he backed off the mic when he was singing Backwoods Nation and didn't drop the F bomb, and none of us really were cursing at that time at all, and I was like super impressed that he would do that for the crowd. And I don't know, like in hindsight, I'm sure that was in the contract or whatever, like for him to play. But could you imagine how many like evangelical 15, 16, 17 year olds were there that may or may not, you know, be super legalistic that would have like rocked? Definitely me.
Yeah.
Well, didn't you ask him not to? Did I make that up when you talked to him?
I don't know. I'm always been really, really way too bold. So
yeah,
there's a possibility that I would have asked him
why he started cursing and all of that stuff. I know you told me that.
I don't know why. I may have dreamed it, but I thought when you guys came back that you said something to the effect of when you were talking to him, you kind of asked him not to do that or something, and then you got really excited when he didn't.
It's yeah.
Then that's probably happened. Probably wouldn't have made
Dave's
that story
reason
up.
That
so,
Dave
was on
the curse during that.
Yeah, I like to believe it's because of you, David.
Yeah. But not like out of respect for David or anything. David was like mouth breathing through a hole in a shed, and he was like,
he was gonna
"Sir,
get
I'll
murdered.
Go away.
He thought that
I'll
was gonna
only
be
go
good.
Away if you don't curse.
Don't you ever curse, and true love waits.
He's just a little golem outside the door.
Yeah, I was like, dude, the mouth breathing. Gosh, I thought it was cool. No wonder I couldn't get a date until I was 30. So, oh my gosh.
I think that's the first time anyone has ever said mouth breathing. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Oh, welcome to the Everything is Okay podcast. All right. At Cornerstone, do you remember there was those folks camping next to us that kept playing Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire in the morning?
Oh, dude.
Gah!
I hated that song for so long.
I hated that song forever.
I mean, every morning, like at 6:30, 7 a.m., which, like, you know, we're just out of high school, like seniors in high school. Like, in the summer, like, man, we don't get up until 10 or something. And, like, here's this, like, guy blaring Ring of Fire Oh, man. So that's how I got introduced to Johnny Cash.
Yeah, which is a terrible way to be introduced to Johnny Cash. Man. He has so many better songs than Ring of Fire.
I'm pretty sure there could be a never-ending conversation of reminiscing because, I mean, it's been like 20 years.
Yeah.
More than 20 years, like 26 years.
Oh, my Lord.
So since Brad's not doing his job, I figure...
Yeah, thanks, Brad. We'll transition. We pick on Brad pretty much every episode. That's one of the themes of Everything Is Okay. Yeah. It's going to be in our new logo. That's hopefully somebody's going to submit to us in the future.
Yeah. Faith, live questions, messing with Brad.
Yeah.
Is he going to go postal this week?
Man, I hope so.
He's going to earn us another explicit rating.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Yeah, we have one episode that's just me cursing.
just 30 minutes of Brad just cursing. Just.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Oh, that's funny.
That doesn't count. All right, so segue. Here we go. We're quiet.
It doesn't count as a segue if you just say segue.
That's how segues work.
Segue.
Guys, I'm leaning forward on my segue headed towards the Gap. I'm now a security mall person. All right, mall security.
Paul Bart.
Dyslexic. So we have Jacob Crumwitty here. You're currently the assistant director, is that right, of the Will Rogers Memorial?
Yeah.
Which we spent a lot of time sledding. And then I think I did my prom pictures.
That's pretty
there.
Much.
Yeah. Is there anything else that Will Rogers Museum offers the world?
Yeah. Besides other those other things? Than playing on his grave.
I mean, that's pretty much the experience most kids have here. It's a long-standing tradition. You sled down the hill in the winters and get your prom pictures there. I've been working there for like 10 years now. Pretty much like when I was an undergraduate, when I was working on my bachelor's, I started there as an intern. And we do a lot of stuff in the community, lots of events, a lot of community events. And we're actually just merged with the Oklahoma Historical Society. So we're in the midst of a master plan to kind of redo a lot of our exhibits in the next coming years. We're really excited about it. So like the museum that's looked pretty much the same for like 3 or 4 decades. Maybe the next time you visit really probably won't look that way. We're kind of excited.
Will it have really weird stuffed animals on the walk down to the creepy kid section?
Oh, those are gone. Yeah, sorry.
What?
We have a children's museum that had some very bad taxidermy, like hanging from the ceiling in the walls. It was terrifying. Just like a dead, rotting owl just hanging in the corner, just staring at kids as they come down the hall.
Oh, my gosh. With a funny eye. Oh, gosh, that funny eye.
Yeah.
So what's your, obviously, 10 years, that's a long time working with an organization. For our listeners who, may surprise you, don't know who Will Rogers is, what's your favorite thing about Will Rogers? I mean, what do you tell people when they're like, Will Rogers?
Well, he was pretty much.
Who's that? Is he related to Beyonce?
If you're looking at the...
Who would ever ask that?
I don't think anyone's asked that before. I think it's the first time. Yeah, no, but like, I mean, if you're looking at the 1920s and 1930s, there probably wasn't a bigger, more popular public figure in the world than Will Rogers. He was, had... At the time of his death, he had a nationally syndicated newspaper column that... You know, went out to 400 plus different newspapers across the country and across the world. One of the top radio shows, weekly radio shows of the time, and was also the top male box office star in the 1930s. So, I mean, he was pretty much the most popular guy in the world. Well, in the United States anyway. Yeah, so a lot of the things I like kind of looking at is the popular culture in the American West. And so he got his start as a Wild West performer in South Africa, and you know, he did a lot of trick roping, things like that, in his early days. So that's kind of the stuff that I like researching.
That's awesome. Very cool. So basically he's the Matthew McConaughey of the 1930s.
If Matthew McConaughey had
he's the JTT.
He's the JTT.
He's the Jonathan Taylor
1930s.
Thomas of the 1930s.
Yeah, that's even a better, that's a perfect analogy. Thank you, James. Like, he's the Simba.
Yeah, I don't know why you would even attempt to go for a bigger star name than Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Why even
but
try?
Whatever.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. All right. All right. So Jacob, we wanted to hang out with you mainly just to tell stories and reminisce from the good times. But on a more serious note, you were not one of the first of our group to get married, because obviously Philip Jackson, party of one. But you were brought up in the Southern Baptist tradition.
Yeah.
You obviously drank the Kool-Aid like we did when it came to like finding that one person on the entire, you know, in the entire earth that you're supposed to be with.
Sure.
We've been brought up to obviously respect marriage, put it on a pedestal. I would argue mm-hmm. have false expectations for what it looks like with very, I didn't have much of a tutorial. You know, my parents were
sure.
are still married, and I got to watch them, and I got to watch a lot of our friends' parents and how they interacted. But much like finances, like there's not really a tutorial as an adult on how to like mm-hmm. navigate that world.
Yeah.
And yeah, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about your relationship and...
Yeah, man. So this is going to be really difficult for me to talk about. I've talked about this whole story with, I don't know, really a few select people over the course of the past, geez, almost like, it's almost been a full year now. I've only really told the whole story to a couple people. And so here I am going to broadcast it over the internet. So this is a little bit of a daunting task and something that I still, you know, it's the whole thing has completely torn apart my world in really every fundamental way that you can imagine. It's been the hardest thing I've ever went through. So it's going to be tough to talk about. So if I like completely break up, like that's just how it is. But yeah, like, so as far as the relationship goes, like you guys mentioned, like, man, like as much as people say through like marriage counseling classes, like you have to do in Oklahoma before you get married, or, you know, it seems like it's all pretty straightforward, you know, everyone seems to be pretty casual about it. Like, oh yeah, this is a pretty simple thing. Just respect each other and, you know, everything's fine. But man, it just doesn't strike the surface compared to what all is out there. And I don't know, talking to everyone that I grew up with, like when we were first getting married, I just really didn't hold a candle to what everything really was. I mean, it just doesn't.
How old were you?
I was 20 okay. when I got married. So I think we were 18, 19 when we started dating, and then got married when I was 20. So incredibly young, you know, and I struggle to think like what the motivation for that was, you know, if it was just like, well, this is what people do, this is the right step, this is, I don't know. And, you know, there was, I think even looking back to when we first got married, there were plenty of problems that kind of showed up early. It's just, you know, both of us were so stubborn and just didn't really have a good handle on how do we actually resolve conflict when it happens. And so, you know, gosh, and one of the more stupid ideas that I've had, like in one of those dark days in this past winter, I'd go back and like read emails, conversations that she and I had like back in 2006, 2007, 2008, like the first couple years of our marriage. And like seeing these things manifest themselves, these problems that like I had these deep hurts within me that I don't think she was even conscious or aware of. And like, I just didn't know how to talk about them. Or I tried and I don't think she understood or something. And that's not to say that like she didn't have things herself that I was missing, because I know that was the case too. But, you know, it was, I don't know, man. The best way I can think of it, it was a long, long time of two people growing apart instead of together. Like a lot of the things that we did in our marriage, we did separately. Like, you know, I didn't want to be that guy that was like, I don't know, like a 1950s husband, like, you're coming with me and doing all this stuff with me together. I didn't want to force her to do something she didn't want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also thought, you know, that she would want to. And so, like, we just never really talked about it. And I was always kind of alone by myself, hanging out with friends. And I didn't really like that. And I just don't think she realized it or what. Like, you know, you kind of wanted to have somebody there with you, but at the same time, I didn't want to be a jerk and, you know, like force her to come hang out with and have fun with me. But yeah, we did a long, long time. We just kind of grew apart. And then there towards the end, I mean, things were so hollow and it was just hard. There wasn't anything left, it felt like. And it was, I don't know, everyone has needs. And, you know, since I've got divorced and, you know, I went to counseling a little bit and have read different things about needs that people have and all that. And I don't know. I think a lot of it's bullshit, honestly. But, you know, I did kind of start to realize that, you know, there were needs that I had that weren't being met. There were needs that she had that weren't being met. And we were just both too stubborn to want to do something about it, to make the first move to actually fix it. And like any sort of like conflict resolution just ended up being like, instead of like, okay, how can we fix this? It was like, okay, how can we preserve the status quo? So like we just had things that just kept adding up, And until, and I, you know, I was stupid enough to think like, I can hold on to this pain and this hurt and I can just like muscle past it. And I didn't. I was, so.
That's a pretty, I mean, just listening to that last statement, I mean, that's a very classic Americanized guy tendency, right?
Totally, yeah.
We are taught from a very, very, very young age to suppress.
Don't talk about your feelings.
Emotions.
Yeah.
Unless it's like laughing or, you know, anger or somewhere in between.
So.
Because we're tough, right? I mean,
yeah,
you're basically like Will Rogers incarnate, so.
Yeah, so like, I don't know, through it all, I thought I was strong enough to hold on to it, and boy, was I wrong. Like, I don't want to go into the, like, nitty-gritty details just because I think that's a little bit crass, but.
Sure.
I ended up having an affair, I don't know, in about the summer of last year. And so, like, life from this point on is not only dealing with the hell of divorce and trying to rebuild your life, but also like living with myself and the fact that I handled the situation the worst way possible. And, you know, like, I don't want to like sit there and point fingers and say like, this is why it happened. There were certainly other factors there that happened too, that I just don't want to go into, but like things that hurt me that she had done, things that I had done too on top of that. But like in the end, when you're kind of broken down and like you have all these things that you need validation and fulfillment that you're just not getting, and thinking that I was strong enough to just muscle through, man, along came somebody that kind of just all of a sudden filled all those needs that I had. And of course it was inappropriate and I did the worst thing I could have, but I did it. And that hellscape after that, like, you know, we went to counseling for a while, and, you know, I was quickly starting to realize that she wasn't going to be able to forgive me. And I completely understood that. I think she was willing to work on it, at least in words, but I was really doubting it in actions. And so I kind of made the choice about this time a year ago that I was done. So we divorced 1st of September last year. And from that point, that was just kind of the leading up to all this. Like, that's hard in and of itself, and it's easily some of the most emotionally traumatic things that I've ever been through. But it was really nothing compared to the next 6 months.
So before you get into the next 6 months, there's probably a lot of people who are either came from kind of our background, or are in committed relationships, or who are married, or who are divorced.
Yeah.
And when you look at this situation and you reflect on not the past 6 months, but the 10 years of relationship, are there any things that, I mean, you've kind of mentioned communication, but are there any things that you're like, hey, for those of you who are in a struggling relationship right now, this is what I would have done.
Yeah. So really, I think, the communication thing is certainly a big deal. But like the best advice I've kind of heard in this whole process and really looking at marriage is always try to, instead of just having a reciprocal relationship where you have a nice back and forth, a nice 50-50 give and take, always try to do it 60-40, like always willing to go a little bit beyond what is expected and to make sure that the other person is happy and is getting their needs met. And if both of you are doing that, then you are conscious of their feelings and their emotional needs and are willing to go above and beyond to do those things. But at the same time, recognizing that you have your own needs that need to be met too. that's something we sure as hell did not do. You know, we tried to communicate our emotions and our feelings in different ways, but it was always like, I don't know, the best way to look at it is like 3 months of hurt and bottling things up until we finally exploded at each other, sort of thing. Like, we were really bad at conflict resolution. And so I think that's the biggest thing, man. Like, being honest with each other and talking about like what really is bothering you, not just like what's on the surface and like what those little stupid arguments are that you didn't win or whatever, but like, what's really hurting you deep down? Like, what are those emotional holes that are just like sucking the life out of you? Because if you don't deal with those, I mean, those are always going to be ever constant, and they're sucking your happiness away. And I think that's one thing that we just didn't do, communicating and resolving conflict effectively. And, you know, that was on both of us. You know, I like to say I always tried, but I don't know. I mean, I would always try to make sure she was okay, but never really talked about myself and like what was really hurting me. And that's just as dangerous as, you know, her not being happy. So I think that's kind of it.
So what, talk a little bit more about the next six months.
So that's where it got weird, man. I went and set my parents down actually almost one calendar year ago. It was right around the fly-in, one of our big events that we have out here. I went over to mom and dad's and told them that what we had decided, that we were going to get divorced. And I told them everything that happened and what I had done and what she had done. And
jeez.
I left that feeling somewhat encouraged, like, you know, I'm not going through this alone. Hmm. But that was the last time like mom and dad and I talked until November, December. And like all my friends were kind of the same way. Like everyone that was in my life, with the exception of my brothers, like they just kind of disappeared. And like, to be fair, a lot of people had no idea what was happening and what I was going through, but some did. And like I...
By disappeared, you mean like you kind of lost connection with them, or it seemed like they...
It varied. Like some of them...
Kind of left.
Some of them, like people that like were just acquaintances or people I'd grown up with in church, friends of ours as a couple... You know, I would hear from some of them, like they'd send me a message on Facebook and, you know, tell me how horrible I was and, you know, how...
What?
Oh, yeah, man. Just kind of... So there was... And, you know, okay, before I get down that road, you know, and some people, you know, like some family members, hell, I still don't talk to some of them. I mean, it's been a really hit and miss. And some of them have just, you know, all out told me to pretty much go straight to hell. Some of them have been very supportive, and some of them have just like checked out and just like, well, I haven't really seen or talked to them since last year. Mm. And people that were a big part of my life too. I don't just mean acquaintances either. And you know, like I don't necessarily, like with my parents, like I struggled with that for a long time, like telling them what I had done, getting divorced and like being just this broken down shell of a person. And man, you just kind of need your family there, and they weren't. And like, I now, like I resented them at the time, but like now I completely get it. Like they hadn't gone through this themselves. Like they hadn't, they didn't know how to act. They didn't know what to do, what to say. Right. And I think I was unjustly hard on them in some ways, because it was hard on them just as much as it was hard on me. They were losing a daughter-in-law. They were losing part of their family as well. But like at the same time, you know, I'm sitting there in September, October, and November just wanting with all my heart for them to reach out and tell me everything was okay. So like this year, the Cubs and the Indians are in the World Series, and it was kind of one of those things. It was like magic. Like the Cubs and the Indians, you know, have this long history of being these longtime lovable losers. And my dad grew up in the north side of Chicago and was a Cubs fan. And I've been a Cleveland Indians fan since I was a little kid. And so they both go to the World Series. And like some of my best memories as a kid were of me and my dad, you know, watching baseball games together, World Series, things like that. And I remember sitting... Here the Indians are going to the World Series. This is late October, early November. Indians and Cubs in the World Series. And I'm sitting there in a bar in Claremore watching it by myself and just kind of silently crying to myself, like thinking, man, this would be awesome to be watching with Dad. And finally, like game seven, he texted me like before the game started and was like, this is literally the first I'd heard from him since that time in August. And he said, you know, do you want to come watch game seven? And I was like, I just started crying. And so that was like that meant a lot. Like that was the first time he had reached out since all of that happened. And I kind of knew everything was okay from there. Well, at least in regards to me and him. But, you know, that was really, I didn't talk to him much after that, but that's just kind of like me and my dad's relationship. We see each other at family get-togethers and kind of just, you know, your typical father and son relationship in the United States, I guess. But, and that's, and like I said, that's, it's one of those things, like it's a generational thing. It's passed down from his father and his father before him, and just awkward not knowing how to deal with love and expressing love. And they, like, I get it. I don't fault him for it. Mom was a little bit later to come around. You know, I eventually went to Thanksgiving dinner, not really knowing if I was invited because I hadn't really heard, but I went anyway. And it was just kind of awkward because no one was really looking me in the eye. You know, I was kind of off by myself, and with the exception of my brothers, you know, I just kind of hang out with them, but like, it just got strange. And then finally in like mid-December, I finally reached out to Mom, or she did with me, and then we went out to eat, went Christmas shopping, things like that, and we just kind of had it out, and everything's been, at least with us, has been awesome from that point on. Like, she pretty much expressed, like, she didn't know how to, as hard as it was on me, like, she didn't know how to deal with it herself, and, you know, just kind of checked out, and she knew it wasn't the right thing, but, you know, didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
From a conflict standpoint, if you are willing, I mean, what kind of examples did you see growing up, maybe with family or with people in your life that you respected? And how do you think that's played into this situation and the aftermath?
You know, you always see people that get divorced. And, you know, I had my own personal idea of how it was going to go. Like, yeah, I sinned. I did the worst thing I could have done. But like in my head, I was like, well, I'll be forgiven by God and man. But that's not really the case. I mean, I don't know. Things are just different now than I think what they were then. I don't know. Maybe it's just it's easy to look at things as a kid and think everything's fine and everything's going well. But like you see instances of people having affairs, getting divorced, and people still being supportive and loving to them. But man, I saw the opposite. Like, I don't know, through the winter, man, I had a real hard time with Christianity as a whole. Not like my relationship with Christ, but Christians in general. Like, they made this the hardest time of my life. Like, it was hard enough, and now I had to deal with the backlash of all that. And like, I get it. Like, I will go through and do that because I think I mean, that's on me. Like, I have to just sit there and deal with the consequences in some way. But like, some of the meanest people I've ever encountered are Christians, like how they've treated me. Like, so, all right, I really dealt with like depression pretty seriously this past year, especially in the winter, to the point of even like suicide. I didn't know how. I didn't think I would see spring. Like, I didn't know how it was going to happen, like when or the details. I just kind of figured, well, this is the end. And like, so talking about Christians, like, I only shared that with a couple people, my ex-wife being one of them. And like, you know, I'd get messages on Facebook like saying, like, you know, I heard you were suicidal. Like, I feel obligated to reach out, but like, I really don't want to, and I really don't care about your well-being. Like, that.
Wow.
And so it's like, I'm serious. Like, I had a real hard time dealing with Christianity. And like, I hear people say, boy, you should really be going to church right now. And I'm like, why? Like, you guys are the meanest people I've ever encountered. And like, sitting there at the bar, drinking my tears away, watching, you know, a baseball game, I completely understand why people get the way that they do. And why, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Like, Christians are terrible to people. especially other Christians.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, I don't know. I think the world, quote unquote, is a little bit more accepting and understanding.
Yeah.
And I completely get it and understand it. Like, I don't, my faith never really wavered. Like, I don't all of a sudden doubt God or his existence or his role in my life or anything like that. But man, I just had no desire to be around other Christians, mostly just because of how they treated me. And I get it, like, that's not everybody, but I don't know. It just made me not really want to reach out myself. And then, like, when somebody is suicidal, like, people always say, like, oh, just, you know, just reach out to somebody, you know, cries for help and all that. I don't know. I found that's pretty much bullshit.
Like, it's the last thing you want to do.
Yeah, like, you have at the, you're at the point that you are because you think that people don't care enough about you to care, and you hear people say that and you think it's fake and it's not real. Like, people say, oh, if you ever need anything, just, you know, give me a holler. Like, that's one thing I've learned from all of this is, like, when people are down, you just force yourself to be a part of their life because they're not going to reach out typically if they're low enough.
Yeah, James and I have absolutely had that conversation because with our generation specifically, I think we're more comfortable expressing the fact that, hey, I deal with depression, or hey, I've hit this point. But like, one of the clear characteristics of like the darkest depression is it literally sucks any energy you have to reach out to folks.
Oh,
to do anything. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely something we've talked about some on the podcast, even that, I mean, depression is not being really sad, and that's what people tend to think. Like, that's not it. You can't just, you know, put on a smile and make it through. And a lot of the same people, it seems, that say things like, you know, if you need anything, just let me know, are the same people that, like you were saying, just kind of check out. And it makes it very disingenuous when you back out of people's lives and then say, I get you're having a hard time, but you come find me if you need it. So with that, like, what are ways people can actually be supportive in those times? Because like you said, with your family, and I know I've had that moment with different people in my life who've had depression or suicidal thoughts or whatever. Like, how do you support people in those times?
Yeah, so like for me, like the biggest thing I needed was, especially in some of those dark days in the winter, was like, I just wasn't comfortable being alone. Mm. Like, that was the biggest thing. Like, I was always scared what would happen if I was by myself for too long. And at the same time, like, I needed somebody to kind of say, not even necessarily say anything, but just know that they were there. Because like, in certain points of the past year, like, there wasn't many people that were. And so like, just having somebody that's there, that you know, that whether they're saying it with their words or not, just saying with their words or actions that everything is okay, is a big deal. And so the more I see this happening, or if experienced it myself, and it, when I start seeing it happen in others, me, I'm just going to force myself into their life and they're just going to have to deal with it. And if they don't want me there, they can tell me. But I think a big thing is just being there for people. And, you know, you see somebody bummed out and sitting by themselves, you don't even have to say anything. Just go sit with them and just let people know that you aren't alone. And that, like, because, I mean, all right. So, like, some of the biggest things in all of this is with the divorce and going through the relationship stuff and everything after it, it's kind of, you know, you don't really think that you're good enough. Mm. Like, you just don't believe it. You can pretend that everything's okay, but like, deep down, you don't think that you're worthy enough for other people's attention and other people's love. And so like, you try to earn it sometimes, but you know that you can't, and you know that those actions are futile. And I've really struggled with that concept, like what unconditional love is, not from God necessarily, but coming from other people. I just don't think it really exists. Mm. Maybe it does. I just haven't figured that out yet, but I don't know. It's very conditional from what I've found. Some of the biggest hurt that you can go through is going through this, and I don't know. You want to feel alone, sin, and see kind of Christianity kind of crumble away and not be there. And that's, again, that's not necessarily fair because that's not everybody, but it was pretty much true with a lot of people in my life.
Is there anybody who Was there anybody who surprised you in a good way?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Probably the reason I made it as long as I did. You guys remember Joe Bruce?
I don't.
He was, he dated my older sister, I don't know, probably when I was in college.
Yeah.
So I think remember you guys him. Probably had moved on by that point.
Yeah, I remember him.
He was, he roomed with Philip Jackson for a while.
Because I think I met him at Philip's wedding or something. It was at a wedding.
Yeah, probably. Him. Yeah. And so, like, he was going through the same stuff as me at the time. He was getting divorced, too. And he was a guy that would literally check on me almost every day. Mm-hmm. We would text back and forth and just, you know, he would... Because we were going through the same thing. You know, our relationships crumbling for different reasons. But, you know, relationships crumbling, not that all the emotions that come along with it and everything else. And so, like, we literally got divorced on the same day. Mm-hmm. So we really kind of... He was one of the people that I could talk to because he knew and understood the emotions I was going through better than really anyone because he was experiencing it, but also experiencing it at the same time, and it was still fresh. So, you know, we would talk back and forth for, I mean, just about every day. You know, and there were a lot of people, honestly. Like, my brother, Ben, you know, he was there a lot. Actually there in person, you know, we would sit and talk and hang out, and that's, you know, a little bit less unexpected, really. But just little surprise things like that. People like with Joe, like, we didn't have a super close relationship back in high school and college, but, you know, we just had this tie that bound us together after that was really meaningful. And, like, I don't know if I would have made it without, you know, someone like him to share everything with. Yeah.
And I've noticed kind of a theme in some, as you were describing it, that you mentioned several times you thought you would be strong enough to deal with emotional hurt. I mean, I feel like most people who know you would have to describe you as like a man's man kind of person, you know, like, I mean, doing stuff on a ranch, you know, building fences, you know, you consider it a good day if you
riding a horse and dislocating my elbow.
Right. Not always graceful. I didn't say graceful.
Right, right.
But, you know, like, it seems like you're the kind of person who has part of your personal value in the amount of calluses you have type.
Yeah. Guy.
And I feel like it's difficult for people who are in that position or really, I think most men start to feel that way. And you just think, I can be strong enough to not need help through any of this. I can be strong enough to not only do it for myself, but for, in this case, my wife as well. Like, I can just be strong enough. Right.
Yeah. A lot of the one little bit of information that I got out of counseling when I was going was, like, understanding that, like, I have a hard time loving myself, like self-love and self-care sort of thing. You expect a lot of your self-worth coming externally. That's like the work sort of stuff. Like, you do the work because you want to feel appreciated and to feel accepted and to feel like you have a place and a role. And that's kind of where that, like, and like I have a better understanding and feeling for, you know, good old boys that do that, because every time I see them working their ass off, I just know and realize they're trying to find love and appreciation from somebody. Yeah. Like, they don't feel it themselves, and they're wanting to try to earn that from somebody. And that's why I have a real hard time, like I said earlier, with the concept of unconditional love, like love that is freely given, not earned, just because that's something that we all kind of grow up with, that you have to earn somebody's love.
Yeah.
It's very anti-American, unquestionably.
Yeah, totally.
And it's also something I feel like we project further onto people because of who you are. I feel like people have a hard time saying, I'm proud of you. Or, you know, like, well done. Words of affirmation, just the simple things that are vocal affirmations of value.
And it's
and those
crazy,
are important.
Like, I hear those words and it, like, makes me break down almost. Like, just, that's like all that is required. That's all that people need sometimes. Yeah. Like, I'm proud of you. You're doing a good job. Something like that. And that just something that people just don't think of doing. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, not to cheese it up, but I'm going to say it. I'm straight up proud of you for getting on this podcast and sharing some like extremely difficult for children earmuffs with us. Like, yeah. Like straight up. I mean, this is, it's, you're talking to three guys who have all hit rock bottom in their own way.
Yeah.
It is so easy for us to miss in our pursuit of whatever we're pursuing, those moments in time where like we can slow down and breathe enough to affirm somebody, to love on somebody, to get out of our own headspace and like share some of that unconditional love that you're talking about. Getting through, I guess one of my favorite parts about hitting rock bottom, and I'm not trying to bring a lot of levity to depression, but one of the beauties of it is that when you do survive rock bottom,
mm-hmm.
Like God or whoever you believe in, I swear shows you a different surface to this existence.
Yeah.
And gives you this energy or this focus that you didn't have, that you can miss for sure when you get caught up with whatever you're doing on your day to day. But you have this view and this experience where you can show love to people in a way that you didn't have before, and I didn't have before, you know, and that's incredible.
Yeah, you know, going through this, all of this, I tried to come out stronger because of it. And again, you know, understanding those little buzzwords that I've, you know, was I strong enough to begin with, all that stuff, yeah. And trying to learn to be stronger. I kind of am conscious and aware of them now, but like, I want to be stronger because of this. And what's been incredibly difficult in the past year is learning to get past all of this. Not just the hurt, but like, how do you rebuild from here? Because I mean, man, this was everything. I mean, I was pretty much destroyed emotionally, financially, really everything. Like my whole world changed. Everything that I had that was just kind of gone, and like, okay, so it's like, you know, the book of Job, you know, all the hell that he went through in the Bible. But at least he had the benefit of saying that he could still claim that he was a good man and he hadn't cursed God. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking like everything's been torn down and there's nothing left. And I can't say that. Like, I'm here because of my actions, my poor actions. So trying to figure out, where do I go from here? How do I rebuild? What does that look like? What does my life look like now? So it's a lot of, from this point on, trying to understand, what is my value? What is my worth? Because it's hard to figure out and understand, one, from a position of this is what is best for me, but also like I need to have a place. I need to fit in. I need to be a part, because I wasn't for so long. I was kind of cast aside for so long. It's more important to me now more than ever. And I understand too, like, that's not necessarily the best approach either, trying to find that external validation from people. But
right.
So that has been a very difficult process, is learning how to rebuild myself, how to navigate all those emotions that I have.
Right.
Where do I put them? How do I react to them? How do I change myself for the better? It's been hard.
I mean,
but I made it this far.
I know. Yeah, you I have. Know that if I think if you polled our group of friends from growing up on like who would be able to be successful in life and, you know, figure out how to make things work and thrive, I feel like you would have been up. I don't know if you could pass a Philip Jackson, but come on. I mean, how many of us could pass Philip Jackson in most categories? But yeah. Like, you always put all of yourself into everything that you did, and I feel like all of us had a deep respect for just who you were, work ethic, all of that. And I definitely, at least for me, post-divorce doesn't change any of that.
Man, I appreciate that.
And like, even in just talking to my brother or my fiance or whomever, saying that we were going to be recording and we were gonna talk to you, like, I couldn't say enough positive to try to embody like who you are, not who you were, but who you are.
Yeah.
So Yeah, we've all messed up. You messing up doesn't change your value.
That's hard. I appreciate hearing that. I can't tell you how much I need that, but it's hard to accept it too, man.
No, like, I completely understand that. It's you know, you've had years of being in your own head telling you the opposite.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're stupid, so shut up. So.
Yeah, that's
true. My advice would start reading more Catholic theologians, which is what I've been doing, which is helping me love myself a lot more. Basically, just become a Catholic.
Yeah.
No, that, one of the hardest things for me personally is to love myself.
Yeah.
Like I am the fiercest critic of myself, and believe me, I have, you know, two fierce critics right here on this call with me. One of the things that I think we miss in the Protestant tradition, at least in the tradition that I grew up in, is that God is outside of time. God is outside of the moment. Mm-hmm. We are perfect. Our soul is perfect from the beginning to the end. Like,
yeah.
Our human side is sinful. And like the unconditional love aspect that we will struggle our entire lives understanding or conceptualizing or internalizing, God sees beauty in ashes.
Mm.
Like Christ sees beauty in our growth, and like we grow when we fail.
Yeah.
We don't grow in status quo.
Yeah.
There's not resurrection.
Yeah. There's not.
Without death.
But with people, and you said this, so humans struggle with unconditional love. Yeah. And unless you can love yourself, and I'm not there. I still don't love myself. I'm trying to get there.
Oh, but
unless you can love yourself, how can you expect to love somebody else?
Yeah. No, that's very true. It's like, it's hard to give love out, especially in a relationship, when you're not feeling a lot of it for yourself and your own life. And it's, gosh, I hope she's figured that out. I hope I do sometime. Life's weird.
One of the biggest things, and I've talked to Megan about this quite a few times, because it bugs me a lot just about every time I hear it. In the evangelical church especially, there's a very big emphasis on you're bad, so bad that you're not good enough, so God had to send his son. Now, he was bloodthirsty, which is atonement theory. He was bloodthirsty, and he had a gun at humanity, but then at the last second, he chose to point the gun at his own son because he just needed that blood. And I've had a big problem with that for a long time, because I just feel like, well, there's one thing that I don't respond well to something like that. If somebody's like, well, you're just a horrible person, then I'll be like, well, then leave me alone. But the second thing is hearing, you know, what you were saying, Jacob, I just wish that when I was sitting in, you know, a church service, that I would hear more of this is who God says you are. Jake, God doesn't say, you know, you're an adulterer.
Right.
You know, that's not who he says you are. God doesn't say that you're a failure. God doesn't say that you're worthless or any of those things. He says you're loved, you're his child, and he's going to and he's throwing a party for you, you know. And I just don't hear that, you know, when you have these invitations and you know, it's a huge emphasis on hell, and it's a huge emphasis on, you know, all the bad that humanity is. And you can see how bad humanity can be when you watch the news and listen to commentaries and things like that. But the thing that keeps bringing me back is that there is a creator who says that I'm worth something.
That's significant.
And that I'm loved.
Yeah.
And I agree, like, Christians at times can be, if not most of the time, can be some of the meanest people that there is. And at some point, I really hope that there's a light of repentance within the church where they realize, like, Jesus wasn't about exclusivity. He was about inclusivity. And the scandalous nature of God was not exclusiveness, was inclusiveness. And he hung out with those people, you know. And I just, being that we're all from the same background, there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, humans are so bad. I don't have a lot of like real fancy words, I guess, but I mirror what these two guys said because, Jacob, you've always been one of my favorite people. You still are. It was a thrill to get to hang with you this last weekend because I got to see you.
Absolutely.
And that will happen again very soon. And I want you to know that, like James said, man, you're our guy. Yeah. So,
man, I really appreciate that. And what you mentioned there too with like being exclusive or inclusive, man, that really hits the nail on the head. Like so much of what Christianity is, at least what I've felt in the past year, is like it's not about God. Mm-hmm. It's a social club almost with some people. Like, and when you like break the social contract, like, well, you're done. You can't be in our club anymore. And even when it's the other way around, where they, you know, you see a church that focuses on being inclusive, like I always feel that it's like synthetic, like it's not real, it's not genuine. Like it's their job to do it, and right. if it wasn't, they wouldn't be doing it. And so, like I have a real hard time. Like I found individuals that are that way, and I've built bonds with them over the past year because no matter what I've said or what I've done, they can still accept me for who I am and love and respect me beyond that. And so those people I've real strong bonds with, and I really appreciate them in my life in the past year, and there's a lot of them in different ways. But yeah, man, that's so true though. Like it's so much of what Christianity is, at least how it manifests itself here in this world, is it's an exclusive thing. It's, this is what my idea of heaven and earth should be, and you're not a part of it.
Right.
That's what it seems like sometimes.
I definitely don't feel like Jesus came because God was angry. I think Jesus came because he thought we all had value.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly different from the narrative that's in churches a lot of the time.
Yeah, man.
And we tend to look at people as every individual is the worst thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
That is their defining moment. And, I mean, that doesn't seem to be the message of Christ at all. Like, it was, he went, like, he walked so much because he was going to find all the people that have been kicked out. Like, that's what he spent all of his time doing.
Absolutely.
So
I thought it was because they didn't have cars, James.
Well, he would have driven to them if he could have.
If Jesus had a car, he'd have driven it. By God,
man, he would have driven a Ford.
Nah, it'd have been a Caddy.
Jesus, man.
None of that foreign nonsense.
When he's cruising around in America, he's driving a Chevy, and you know it.
That's right.
I hope that in one of our future episodes, we spend a lot of time talking about the tribal nature of Christianity. I think we hit on it. The more I learn and the more I challenge my own constructs in my mind, the more I see that God is and instead of either or, and it's rocking me right now. It's rocking me because everything inside of me is, that's either great or terrible. That's good or bad. They're in, they're out. I like Jacob's shirt. I don't like James' shirt. Jacob, you're looking great right now, for real. It's how our mind works though, right? Like, it's, do we dare to challenge that? And being divorced in many of American churches is, you're putting the out group. And how are you supposed to love a child of God when they're in the out group?
Love those unlovable, or what's love good for?
We are the definition of unlovable.
Right.
Everything is okay is all about being unlovable.
Yeah. The church is supposed to basically be the island of misfit toys.
Yeah. Dude, I'm telling you, dude. Jacob, if you're in hell, I'll see you there. And we're going to have a hell of a time. So,
I mean, if... I agree with you that it's hard to find a community that seems genuine when trying to be inclusive, if they care about inclusivity at all. But if you are really searching for a community like that, move to old Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Well, hey.
We got you covered.
I'll think about that.
It's one of the most unique groups of people I've ever been around.
Other single ladies. And we can probably get you a job, too. Dude, forget Oklahoma. They're not even listening to this podcast, so.
We need 100 more listeners from Oklahoma for Jacob to stay.
You know, they had, there's one thing, I think I've heard it on a podcast before, I couldn't tell you which one, probably the Liturgist, Science Mike, any of those, but, you know, all the heretics. You know, I heard this, and it makes perfect sense, especially when you look at the way our country is acting at the moment. And Americans, especially white evangelical Americans, it feels like tends to see themselves as if they're Israel. And the problem with that is that if those same people would actually read the Bible,
sure,
they would see that Israel was the oppressed nation. They were the nation that had people with their foot on the throat, or had their, you know, had people's feet on their throat. And the problem with the way we see ourselves as a nation is that right now we are Canaan and we are Babylon and we are all those people who were sticking feet on people, on the Israelites. And the reason I bring that up is because David mentioned, you know, hitting rock bottom. I definitely hit it. I know David did, and Jacob, I know you did, and James, I know you did too. And I think one of the things that does is you start to identify more with the Israel of the Bible a little bit. It's like I was talking to a friend of mine at work. He's been a guest on this podcast, but I was talking to him about how the Bible, it comes alive to him because he totally understands the God that rescues the oppressed. He's a person of color. He's been cast out with that, and so he totally understands. And I wish that more of the church would change the way they think, because we're all the island of misfit toys, and until we see that, there can't be unconditional love, in my opinion, because we think that there's a hierarchy. I don't know, man. It's a crazy thing, but I think conversations like what we're having is very, very important.
Sure.
For that reason.
Yeah, and like, man, trying to figure out, like I said, where to go from here. Like, that's such a difficult thing to figure out. How to rebuild myself. What's that going to look like? Where is that going to be? Who with? You know, it's hard to figure out. Everything changes. Everything changes from the point that from about a year ago. Everything has changed, and part of me, and unfortunately it happened way more than I wanted it to, but part of me just crumbled, and the other part of me is out there thinking, like, all right, now's the time for me to buckle my sword and pistol by my side and go adventuring and reinvent myself into something greater than I was. And that's what I'm really excited about. Once that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's going to be, like I said, and what life's going to look like, but I've made it. I made it through the winter, and...
Yeah. Now off to Mississippi.
No, maybe so. Dude, with a beard like that, a hairline like that, and you ride horses, dude, you'll kill it down here.
Yeah, just ride a horse all the way down.
I'll show up with, like, dislocated elbows and shoulders.
Dude, like the Clint Eastwood you are.
Just imagine him with a cowboy hat riding a horse down 98 right into town.
So, Jacob, do you have anything? You know, we like to let whoever we're talking to kind of have the last word. Is there anything that you have kind of as a summary based on, you know, what you've kind of learned through all this? And
yeah, man. So, like, one thing I've kind of realized in the past couple of weeks, and I posted something similar on Facebook a while back, but it's like You know, I've come to the realization that, like, I've been so calloused and well, hurt and really so incredibly focused on myself through a lot of this process of, like, well, people did this to me, people weren't there for me, and it's all been internal. And I've realized too that, like, man, I'm not the only one out there that's hurting. People out there are going through sometimes the same stuff I am. Maybe the context is a little bit different, but it's really shown me that, like, all right, I've learned a lot of valuable insight from this is about what life is and how to deal with things. And, yeah. You know, I have a little bit of a responsibility, I feel like, from this point on, is to make people's lives a little bit better than they were. And, like, you have a choice. Sometimes I've realized, you guys said early in the podcast at the beginning, like, we don't have the answers necessarily. We're always, like, searching for the answers, but you don't necessarily have them. And, like, that's one thing I've realized from one point forward, you either get past something or you don't. That's really all life is sometimes. There's not, like, a magic, some sort of point where you just realize, oh, this is how I'm better. You just have to decide, I'm going to get through this. And you go forward and make yourself something better. And, like, it's really kind of shown me that that's kind of what our role is in this world, is not just to get past things, but help people along in that process too, to reach out and be that person that, I don't know, that a lot of people don't get.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I will just kind of add for anyone listening who's going through times like that where they feel very alone and everything. I get we kind of mocked a little bit of the people saying, you know, just reach out, but let us know and yeah, we'll keep up with you.
It's definitely hard to reach out sometimes, but those who do, I don't know, it's our responsibility to make sure that that they're okay.
Yeah. And we've all been there. So if you send us a message on any of our ways of contacting us, we'll get in contact with you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for being willing to open up to us. I really, really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Gosh, thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. So with that, we'll go ahead and end this episode. I'm Brad Stair.
I'm David Meggs.
I'm James Eisenhower.
And I'm Jake Crumweedy.
Everything's okay, people.
Soaking wet, still trying to outrun the things I can't forget. I close my eyes and try to face my fears when it all comes back. The last 20 years, my daddy fought a war and his dad too. I guess that you could say it's what I was born to do. Before too long, they were calling me a man. They shipped me off to basic, they put a gun in my hand. Soldier, trying to move ahead, but always looking over your shoulder. I can't say that I agreed with it all, but I did what I did when duty called. My plane touched down in Afghanistan, where the wind burns your face, keeps your boots full of sand. Across a desert full of IEDs to bring your brothers back so they don't have to bleed. Tour after tour, I grew to accept decisions weren't made.